binaries of spinning black holes. You might have heard about binaries of spinning black holes earlier, maybe in other talks of this month. But I'm going to try to view the topic from a different angle. So I'm going to try to convince you that spinning black hole binaries are actually a way to test gravity and cosmology. So first, a brief outline of the talk. I'll start with the motivation. Why are black hole spins important in the first place? So you're probably familiar with this, but to remind you, I'll go through three examples coming from gravity, from astrophysics, and from cosmology. So the first example I want to talk about is the frame dragging of inertial frames in both isolated and binary black holes. And I will explain how that is related to the efficiency of the emission of electromagnetic and gravitational radiation. Then I'll go briefly through another effect, which probably some of you are not familiar with, and that's known as Bardeen-Petersen effect. It's essentially the interaction between the frame dragging of inertial frames and the viscosity of an accretion disk. And I will explain why that is relevant for gravitational wave emission. And the final effect that I'll talk about, and which will allow me to transition to the main part of the talk, will be about the emission of jets by supermassive black holes. So I will explain why, how jets come about from general relativity, and how they influence the galaxy as a whole. Which the galaxy that hosts supermassive black holes. And this will allow me to go to the main part of the talk, where we'll try to convince you that we can use observations from future gravitational wave detectors to test actually galaxy formation. And in particular, I'll try to convince you that it's important to measure the spin of supermassive black hole binaries. So I will, in particular, talk about the future gravitational wave detectors, such as ELISA or the Einstein Telescope. But in the third part of the talk, I'll try to talk about something more general, which has to do also with present ground-based detectors such as LIGO, although I'm not sure I'll be able to make it today. Something which is not in this talk, although I had time to talk a little bit with some of you about that, is another use of gravitational waves and another use of black hole spins, namely trying to test GR and alternatives to it using spins and gravitational waves. And this is something I recently did some work about. In particular, I did some work about testing the equivalence principle with gravitational wave observations or trying to constrain violations in the Lorentz symmetry in the gravity sector. So if you're interested in this, feel free to stop by. I'll be around all this afternoon. But as far as this talk is concerned, I'll mainly focus on the second part. So why are black hole spins important in the first place? So you all know that the spin of a curved black hole influences the position of the innermost stable circular orbit, what we call the ISCO. And this, you all know that the ISCO actually moves inwards as you increase the spin of the black hole. And this is not just of academic importance, it's actually of very deep astrophysical significance because the position of the ISCO actually regulates what we call the efficiency of electromagnetic emission by the accretion disk. So it's actually the efficiency with which an accretion disk can convert potential or kinetic energy into electromagnetic energy. So this is something astrophysicists use every day to measure the spin of black holes, because it turns out that this radiative efficiency actually depends on the spin of the black hole. So it increases when you increase the spin of the black hole and tops 42% for an extremal black hole. So this is something you can actually use in astrophysics. And that's the first example of the importance of the spin in astrophysics. So another example comes from black hole binaries. So it's essentially the same example.
Sorry, quick question. So usually they say maximal spin is plus one, but in your case it's minus one. Is that right?
Say again? No, the minus one means retrograde accretion. Yeah, no, usually in astrophysics we don't believe there are maximally spinning black holes. The maximum spin that you can have in the case of thin disk accretion is 0.99.
You're right.
What is the observable here?
So again, this radiative efficiency. Well, you measure the spectrum, for instance, the X-ray spectrum, and the radiative efficient comes about in the spectrum. Yet you don't really measure just the radiative efficiency. You measure the entire spectrum of the accretion disk. And this, in particular, depends on the radiative efficiency.
Where is the first
one? What's that again?
Where is the vertical axis?
That's the radiative efficiency, sorry.
The one above it.
The one, oh, this is the position of the ISCO, the radius of the ISCO, the innermost stable circular orbit. Okay, so yeah, the ISCO essentially, if you have a test particle in a Kerr space time, circular orbits only are possible outside a certain radius, and this is the where, for instance, if you have an accretion disk, the accretion disk ceases to exist at a certain radius. Yeah, and you have the same actually effect in the case of a binary system. If you have a binary system of black holes, you can define an effective disk, so the binary in spirals and, on quasi-circular orbits until it hits an effective disk of the system. You can define an effective innermost stable circular orbit, and this again depends on the values of the spin symbol. So if you have a binary whose spins are, for instance, coming up of the screen, and the orbital angular momentum is also coming out of the screen, and the angular momentum is pointing inwards. So if you have spins that are anti-aligned with the orbital angular momentum, the effective disk of the system lies at large radii. Just like in the case of an isolated black hole, if you have retrograde accretion, the disk radius lies at large radii. So you have the same effect in the case of a binary system. So if you have spins pointing up and orbital angular momentum pointing down, the binary starts plunging at large separations. Whereas if you have spins that are actually aligned in the same direction as the orbital angular momentum, you have an effective ESCO at smaller radii, and therefore you have many more cycles before you plunge. And this is again something that's important astrophysically, because just in the same way in which the spin of an isolated black hole regulates the efficiency, the radiative efficiency of an accretion disk, the spins of a binary system regulate the efficiency with which gravitational wave radiation is emitted. So in particular, here I'm considering a system of two equal mass black holes. And I also assume that the two spins are aligned with the orbital angular momentum of the binary. So, and they also assume that the magnitudes of the two spins are the same. So what I'm plotting here is the final mass of the system, so the final mass of the black hole remnant that you obtain from the merger of the two initial black holes over the initial mass of the system. So the difference between the initial mass of the system and the final mass of the system is actually the gravitational radiation that you emitted during the lifetime of this system. And this, as you can see, this difference, so the final mass decreases as you increase the spins involved in the system. So in general, if you have a merger of two extremal black holes, you emit as much as 11% of the energy, of the mass energy of the system into gravitational radiation. So the bottom line is the higher the spins that you have in the system, the more gravitational wave you emit. And the same in an accretion disk, the higher the spin, the more electromagnetic waves you emit. And this is why black hole spins are important.
This is trivial, but why is it not symmetric about?
Oh yeah, negative. So negative values means that the spins are pointing in the negative direction, and orbital angular momentum is pointing up. So it's actually not symmetric for that reason. That's a good question. Well, I didn't explain clearly the theorem of light. So you heard about this already. I guess you know about ground-based detectors, so I don't want to bore you with all this. I was told by Bianca that you heard all the talks about gravitational wave detectors. I just want to say that we have gravitational wave detectors on the ground, which will come online in essentially 2 years. So we have the LIGO detectors in the US, Virgo, an Italian-French collaboration in Italy. And these will allow us to detect black hole spins to very high accuracy. But this will be for black holes that have a mass comparable to the mass of the sun. So these are relatively small black holes. Now, in the universe, we believe there are even more massive black holes than the mass of the sun. We believe there are, at least in the center of galaxies, black holes that have a mass of about a million or even a billion solar masses, and we call these supermassive black holes. And so there are plans in Europe for Michelson-Morley interferometer in space, which goes under the name of EBISA, European LISA, Laser Interferometric Space Antenna, which will allow us to measure the masses and spins of black holes, of the monster black holes that live in the center of our galaxy, and in the center of all galaxies. And in particular, they will allow to do so up to very high redshift, up to redshift of 10 and 15. So they will allow us to essentially detect all the supermassive black hole binaries of the entire universe, essentially. So this was the first effect I wanted to talk about. So the Frayn-Dragin an effect is active collision.
So what is Einstein telescope?
That's an underground detector, again, a European project of arm length of about 10 kilometers. So the reason why you want to go underground is to minimize seismic noise, because you would think that, so the reason why you want to go in space in the first place is because there are vibrations on Earth, and those are reflected in the separation between the mirrors of your interferometer. So on the Earth, you have seismic noise, but we call it seismic noise, but it's really just people walking, trucks passing by, the waves of the ocean have a big effect, so you want to go underground to minimize those effects. And you want to have a larger arm
length. Isn't that actual seismic noise?
Yeah, there's an actual seismic noise. In fact, these detectors can actually be used to detect, people are trying to use them to detect oscillations of the nucleus of the Earth, which is something like the holy grail of geophysics, and nobody was able to detect them. And these instruments are so sensitive, and they're trying to use them to actually do geophysics, not just gravitational physics.
So you didn't list Einstein telescope there, so I'm...
Didn't I?
It's up there, Einstein.
And this will be sensitive to intermediate mass black holes. So black holes having mass between 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4 sort of mass. So the other effect I want to talk about is because it will have a big impact in what I'm going to say later, is the interaction between the spin of a black hole and an accretion disk. So this is known as Bardeen-Peterson effect, but it's really just the interaction of the spin of a black hole with the viscosity of an accretion disk. So now in textbooks, you never see pictures of accretion disks which are off the equatorial plane. And there's a reason for that. So if you start off with an accretion disk which is not on the equatorial plane of a black hole, the interaction between the frame dragging and the viscosity of the disk actually warps the inner part of the accretion flow, which actually turns out to flatten and lie on the equatorial plane. And this happens very quickly. And on a also very quick time scale for astrophysical purposes, about 10 to the 5 years, which is a short time scale when it comes to cosmology, so much shorter than the time scale on which the black hole accretes matter, you have that the accretion disk exerts a torque, and this torque realigns the spin of the black hole with the orbital angular momentum of the accretion disk. So this is amounts to saying that in astrophysics, it's very hard actually to have, for a long time, accretion disks that do not lie on the equatorial plane of the black hole. So this is something which I find very interesting because it tells us something about the interaction between a black hole and its surroundings. So if you have a black hole binary that lives in a gas-rich environment, because of this interaction between the viscosity of the matter and the spin of the black hole, you expect that the spins of the two black holes will be aligned with the orbital angular momentum of the matter present around them. So in general, if you have a gas-rich environment with a lot of angular momentum, you would expect the spins of the black hole to align with the orbital angular momentum of the matter. Whereas if you have very little gas, this alignment effect that I described is inefficient. So you would expect the spins of the black hole to be misaligned. And this is something that you can tell with gravitational waves. So because the waveforms, the gravitational waveforms for a system of two aligned spin black holes are completely different from the waveforms for a system of two precessing black holes, because you see a lot of modulations in the case in which the spins are not aligned. And this is because the spins precess. In post-Newtonian theory, in GR, we know that the spins, if they are not aligned with the orbital angular momentum, they precess and they cause all these modulations. So if a gravitational wave detectors will see a signal like this, it means that the spins are misaligned and therefore the binary most likely lives in a gas poor environment. Whereas if you see a signal like this, a smooth amplitude for the gravitational wave signal, it most likely means that the binary was formed in a gas-rich environment. So, and this is something, again, that allows you to do astrophysics with gravitational wave detectors. So it's a link between matter and gravitational wave observations. Well, the other thing I'm going to talk about today is the link between, again, black holes and their surroundings. So in particular, I will focus about the interaction between black holes and their host galaxies. So I'll try to convince you, and hopefully I'll manage to do so, that you can use observations of massive black holes in binaries through gravitational wave detectors to learn something about the galaxy that hosts them. And in principle, you would think that this is an impossible task, because the of the shear separation of lengths between the black hole and the galaxy. So if you have a, I said, in the center of a galaxy, you have these monster black holes of about a million or even billions solar masses. But still, if you calculate the size of the event horizon of one of these black holes, this is puny. This is 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 7 parsecs. A parsec is about 3 light years, just to give you the order of magnitude. And even the quantity, and even the matter that feels the influence of the black hole is actually pretty small, on pretty small scale compared to the case of the galaxy. So the galaxy is typically tens or hundreds of kiloparsecs, whereas black holes are very small inside the galaxy. So the reason why we think that black holes can say something about their own host galaxy is that we do see these beautiful jets in certain galactic centers called active galactic nuclei. So we see very powerful jets, for instance, in the radio, which are emitted from the center of the galaxy and which travel towards the outskirts of the galaxy. And they're believed to transfer a lot of energy into the galaxy. So these jets transfer energy to the galaxy, and therefore they heat the galaxy up. And if you heat the gas of the galaxy up, the gas cannot form stars, because stars essentially form when the gas of the galaxy cools down. So if you keep injecting energy into the galaxy, you stop star formation. And in fact, this is what we believe happens thanks to these jets. This is what astrophysicists call the NAGN feedback. So there's a link from the small scales of the black hole to the large scales of the galaxy. So this is why this is why the black hole has an influence on the galaxy itself, through these very powerful jets. And these jets are actually a strong field prediction of GR. This is an old calculation which was performed in the 70s by Blandford and Znaek. If you have a spinning black hole immersed in an external magnetic field, essentially because of one version of the Penrose process, you can emit very powerful jets along the spin of the black hole. So this is why black hole spins are important in astrophysics, because they can be used to launch jets, and jets can affect the galaxy as a whole. And more recently, Louis Lennon, who's here at Perimeter, showed that a similar effect can happen if you have a binary system of black holes moving in an external magnetic field. So you could launch very similar jets, and then these jets could have an effect on the galaxy. So I hope I have convinced you that studying black holes is actually doesn't make sense to study black holes alone without studying their host galaxies, because you want to study first of all black holes are fed by the gas which is contained in the galaxy, because this gas forms accretion disks around them, and on the other hand, black holes themselves back react on the galaxy through these jets. So it's a two-way street. Black holes eat from the galaxy, but they also destroy their own mother. And this is actually something that galaxy formation models use every day, because this is we actually have hints that this is what happens in the real universe, because we see that very large galaxies are actually very old ones with very little star formation. So in the Lambda CDM model, in the standard cosmological model, you would expect that large galaxies are those which are formed the most recently. Because you start with very small galaxies, and these galaxies merge as time goes by. Whereas when we look at the sky, we see that that the biggest galaxies are the oldest ones. And this is, again, related to the presence of jets, because the biggest galaxies have the biggest jets, the most powerful jets, and therefore they have the biggest impact on the galaxy. Well, this is hopefully the overall motivation of my work. So the question I want to answer now is, can we learn something about, because black holes are linked to the evolution of galaxies, can we learn something about astrophysics, about galaxies, by looking at gravitational waves from black holes? And this is something I tried to answer, a question I tried to answer last year. So in principle, you could simply run a numerical simulation of the entire universe, from the megaparsec scale, or actually the 3,000 megaparsec scale of the Hubble radius, down to the subparsec scale of black holes, and run the simulation forever. So if you had infinite time and infinite computational resources, naively you could think you could do that. However, this is not really the case, because actually when it comes to astrophysics, the universe is a complicated place, so we there are actually bits of physics that we don't understand, especially on a small scale. So there are non-linear dissipative effects that we don't understand. So a better approach is to use what we call in technical jargon a semi-analytical galaxy formation model. So we try to apply some of the physics that we know and compare that to observations and use observations to fill the gaps when we don't understand the physics. So I have a semi-analytical galaxy formation model in which I have different components. So as you know, maybe I can show this figure. So this is a cartoon of what a galaxy is in my model. This is an artist impression. So this very big ball of dark, this is what we call the dark matter halo. So this is a big ellipsoidal configuration of dark matter. So these particles here are supposed to be dark matter particles in the artist's imagination. And then this dark matter halo is filled by what we call an intergalactic medium, an IGM or hot gas. This is a hot gas component with very low metallicity. And this is hot. And then what happens is that this hot gas pulls down because it emits electromagnetic waves, for instance, through atomic lines. And when this hot gas cools down, it forms what we call galaxy when we look at the star. So it forms these beautiful disk structures. Inside these structures, we have what we call a spheroid, essentially a ball of stars. And inside here, 10 orders of magnitude smaller than this galaxy, is the black hole. So what I want to study with my model is the interaction between this small black hole and the huge surroundings. And as I said, because of jets and because of accretion, you can't study the black hole separately from its host galaxy. I'll go very quickly through the components of the model and how I do things. So for the dark matter, I use what we call a dark matter merger tree. So I essentially use some semi-analytical prescription based essentially on the theory of perturbations laid down by inflation at the end of inflation. And you assume essentially that these perturbations grow linearly, and then you include corrections for the nonlinear effects through a top hat collapse model. So this is something that probably cosmologists in the audience can relate to. But in the end, it really comes down to what we call a merger tree. So you start at very high redshift with very small galaxies. And as time goes by, these galaxies attract matter from their surroundings. So they accrete gas and dark matter from their surroundings, and they grow. But also, they merge at some point, because Newtonian gravity simply pulls them together. So at some point, you start these small galaxies start merging. And then they merge more and more until you end up with just one big dark matter halo at recent times. I don't want to enter too much into the details here, but so then what I want, and this was this big dark matter halo on megaparsec scale. Then what I want to include is the effect of this hot, diffuse hot gas component. So this is simply the, as I said, dark matter halos, because of Newtonian attraction, they accrete matter from their surroundings. And so whenever you accrete dark matter, we know that cosmologically, on large scales, we have a fixed ratio between the baryonic mass and the baryonic density and the density in dark matter. So whenever dark matter is accreted, it brings together some baryonic component. And this is what we call the hot gas phase. There are some technical details in here. So I'm not sure how much I should go into the details. But the thing is this gas is really hot. So it's about at the virial temperature of the halo. So it emits electromagnetic waves. It has a small metallicity, but it has some emission lines. So it emits in the electromagnetic spectrum. And whenever you emit electromagnetic radiation, you cool down. So what happens is that this huge ball of hot gas that you initially have, which is rotating and supported by the velocity dispersion of the various particles inside it, cools down. So there is no support anymore that prevents this hot gas from collapsing, but you still have the centrifugal force. So you have this cloud of gas which cools down. And when it cools down, the centrifugal force is still there. So you form essentially a disc-like structure, simply because you conserve angular momentum, if you want. That's another way of saying that. And when you do so, you form this beautiful spider structure that we see in many galaxies in the sky. And this is what actually what we see in a real galaxy with the Hubble Space Telescope. So I have a recipe for these disks. So, I mean, I don't want, again, enter too much into the details. I calculate the structures of these galactic disks simply by conserving mass and angular momentum. So this is simply Newtonian mechanics. And then these are disks made of gas. At some point, you will form stars in these galactic disks. So I have a recipe for how you form stars. And one other effect that's important is that whenever you form stars, you also have supernova explosions. Supernova explosions, so very massive stars, about more than tensor masses, they explode. They are very, they have a very short life. They explode a supernova, and then they inject energy into their surroundings simply by means of outflows, essentially. So this is an effect that I take into account in my model. And so from the gaseous disk that I have initially, you form a stellar disk. So both this stellar disk and this gaseous disk can actually become, they grow more and more matter, and they become self-gravitating. And whenever they become self-gravitating, they develop what we call bar instabilities. And whenever they develop bar instabilities, they get disrupted, and they form what we call a spheroid. So this, the central part, luminous central part of the galaxy, is actually a disk gone wrong, a disk which has become too big, and which has been disrupted by bar instabilities. And I have also, well, a recipe for how you track the evolution of this, what we call galactic bulges. So I form stars inside them. I follow supernova explosions, so on and so forth. Well, yeah, this is quite complicated, but unfortunately, this is what, because our universe is complicated. So the last thing that I include in my model, as far as the galaxy part is concerned, is the merger between two galaxies. So the crucial thing that I mentioned in the beginning is that as time goes by, dark matter halos, they merge. And this is when two galaxies, when two dark matter halos merge, also the baryonic content of the two galaxies merge. And this is actually what we see in the sky. This is actually a real picture from the Hubble Space Telescope. So you see two galaxies coming together, and you see tidal effects. The galaxies become tidally deformed. And whenever two galaxies merge, also the black holes inside the galaxies, they themselves, they merge, and they emit gravitational waves. So I follow, again, the merger of galaxies. So I include all those tidal effects that I just mentioned that you could see in that picture. So I follow those. I include effects such as dynamical friction, tidal stripping, and so on. If you're not an astrophysicist, you're probably unfamiliar with that. But these are all effects that are there and that you need to track. But most importantly, what you need to take into account is whether two galaxies merge if the two components that merge have roughly the same mass or very different masses. Because if they have very different masses, essentially the merger doesn't affect the big guy. The small guy cannot affect the structure of the big guy. Whereas if two galaxies having roughly the same mass merge, that beautiful disk structure that I showed you actually gets destroyed. So in my model, I follow this. This is something that you see in numeric simulation. They implement very simply in my model. So if the mass ratio between the two galaxies is pretty large, I call this a major merger. And therefore, in that case, the galactic disk get disrupted, and they get transferred to the spheroidal component. Well, this is about this is all I want to say about the galactic part. Now comes the black hole. So as I said, the purpose of all this is to study the jets emitted by the black holes and their interaction with the galaxy. And this is again an image that you see in the. But
many galaxies don't have disks. Elliptical.
Yeah, but we believe that ellipticals had jets before. So not all galaxies. We see a picture of the sky. An instantaneous picture. That doesn't mean because a galaxy doesn't have a jet now that didn't have a jet in the past. We actually believe that most galaxies, especially at high masses, went through a quasar or a GM phase.
There are plenty of ellipticals that have jets. I mean, we showed M87, and M87 is a vertical galaxy. The ellipticals he's producing are major mergers.
Yeah, major merge.
Right, but then that won't fall in under this simulation, right?
Why would that fall?
A disk plus a ball.
There is no simulation.
Yeah. No, not this picture. I'm talking about the recent example.
No, in my model, I do have jets and ellipticals, right? Because you have major mergers. Typically, in major mergers, they call star bursts of star formation, and typically, as I will explain, they are related to the accretion of the black hole. So black holes accrete.
I guess the question is, do you include elliptical galaxies in your model?
Yeah, the elliptical galaxies are the bulge component I'm talking about. That's an elliptical galaxy. So if you have no disk, if the disk get disrupted by major mergers or by instabilities, you have an elliptical galaxy, essentially. Yeah. Well, now I want to go through very quickly through the black hole recipe. So I place, you have to start from somewhere. So if you start with zero mass for your black holes, they can grow whatever they want, but it will never grow. So they will never develop a significant mass. So you have to start with what we call a seed model for the black holes. So in particular, in astrophysics, we think there are two possibilities. Either you start with very small seeds, about 150 solar masses at high redshift, and these are supposed to be the remnants of population 3 stars. Or you start with higher mass seeds at lower redshift, and these are believed to develop from the collapse of protogalactic disks. And this is at higher redshift, 10-15. So I follow both. I choose, since we don't know which one is the correct one, I try both options in my model. Black holes, they accrete through what I call a quasar phase. So whenever you have one example of what I said in the beginning, wherever we don't know exactly the physics, we use observations to guide us. So whenever you plot the luminosity function of quasars, we see that function peaks at about redshift 2. And if you plot the star formation rate as a function of cosmic time, that peaks at about 3. So you see that the star formation rate and the quasar luminosity, they peak at roughly the same time with a small delay. So to implement this in my model or in similar models, what you assume is that the feeding of the black hole, the mass that falls in the accretion disk, is proportional to the star formation rate in the bulge. So whenever you have, for instance, a major merger, you have star bursts, and those feed the reservoir from which the black hole accretes. So this is the recipe that I use, and because we don't know the exact physics that's behind this, I leave this proportion. So psi is the star formation rate, and dot res is the feeding rate of the accretion disk, in a sense. And this is a free parameter of the model. And then I assume that this accretion disk accretes in a quasar phase on the black hole, and I leave the lifetime of the quasar as a free parameter. Well, I also have, and this is the one point, please.
Could we go back to that bottom there? So you say M dot can be super Eddington?
Yeah, this is.
So normally you assume some sort of efficiency. That's typically on the order of 10%.
No, here I use the efficiency. No, the efficiency here I calculate through the spin of the black hole. That's how I define it.
So people try to estimate what that is.
Yeah, the average is 0.1, in fact. Yeah, I mean, it's from a Sultan argument, you see that you can't have very highly spinning black holes in the universe. If you have a model in which you have very highly spinning black holes, you can't explain both the luminosity function of quasars and the black hole mass function.
So once you have, I guess there are two separate questions. One is beyond something like a simple Sultan argument, people have tried to make explicit,
I have a slide on that later, if you want.
Oh, okay. So then I guess you'll come back to that. The other thing is, what does it mean to be super Eddington once you've selected an efficiency? Super Eddington in M dot, but not in.
Well, I mean, what I do, I limit the luminosity, but I don't limit the accretion rate. I mean, I can also relax. The results are not very much dependent on this. I also have a model in which I put a limit on the mass accretion rate, and that doesn't really change the results. But as far as the results that I'm presenting here, I put a limit. You can define the Eddington luminosity as the luminosity if you think of how the Eddington luminosity is defined in terms of Thompson scattering, that's defined in terms of the luminosity. And then the mass accretion rate follows from there. But if you look at the I think this accretion in the classical Shakura-Shinihara paper, actually you can have logarithmically mass accretion rates that are logarithmically superadjunct. And this is one effect I include in the model, but again, I relaxed that and I have different prescriptions. It's not really important. That's why I didn't want to touch it. Well, the one thing I wanted to touch is that.
So one thing I don't understand here is, I mean, usually we think this accretion events are episodic, that sometimes.
Yeah, in fact,
so,
that's what
so
I.
So where is that captured here?
Yeah, it's through the star formation rate, because star formation, this is the star formation in the bulge. Bulges are for the they undergo star formation whenever a major merger happens, and that's the burst or star formation.
And for the merger rates, you use like Preschecter? Or?
Yeah, I use an extended Preschecter, corrected to account for the, yeah. There are some modifications to reproduce embodied simulations, the Millennium Run. So it's essentially extended Preschecter, yeah. Okay, the one thing I wanted to convey though is that when looking at accretion, that's where the effect of the spin is important. The Bardeen-Peterson effect is important. So in particular, if you have a black hole that is surrounded by a very by a very large accretion disk, so a black hole in a gas-rich environment, the Bardeen-Peterson effect that I mentioned initially will align the spin of the black hole with the spin of the accretion disk. So essentially, all the accretion onto the black hole will be coherent. So the black hole will accrete through a thin accretion disk. Whereas if you're in a gas poor environment, the black hole will eat molecular clouds that pass by. And these molecular clouds in general will have can have any direction of the orbital angular momentum. And because essentially the black hole will accrete in all directions in a sense, because there is no Bardeen-Peterson effect that aligns the spin of the black hole with the orbital angular momentum of the accretion disk, because the angular momentum on the accretion disk is too small to align the spin of the black hole. So this is what I do. In fact, I distinguish between two phases, one in which if the black hole has mass, which is much less than the reservoir of gas around it, I assume the Bardeen-Peterson effect aligns its spin with the orbital angular momentum of the accretion flow, and then I have coherent accretion. Whereas in gas poor environments, where the mass of the black hole is much larger than the mass in the gas, you expect to have chaotic accretion. So the black hole eating molecular clouds with random distribution of the orbital angular momentum. And this has a crucial implication for the spin, because if you accrete matter coherently, then you spin the black hole up, because all accretion happens on a prograde orbit. Whereas if you accrete matter with random distribution of the orbital angular momentum, on average, if you do the calculation, it turns out that you spin the black hole down. So you had two regimes. In gas-rich environment, your black hole spins up through coherent accretion. In gas-rich environment, in gas-poor environment, the black hole spins down. And I distinguish these two phases. And the only reason why I can distinguish these two phases is because I have that complicated machinery that follows the entire evolution of the galaxy. Because only through that I can calculate how much mass is in galactic centers. Well, I'll skip this slide. So I just want to say that black holes, they also undergo what we call accrete through what we call a radio mode. So they accrete. So you remember this huge cloud of gas. Black holes also eat from that huge cloud of gas. And that's essentially spherical accretion. But let me skip this. And the last thing I include is the effect of jets. So in principle, if you want to study the jet of black holes, you should run a numerical GRMHD simulation. Fortunately, people have been fitting the results of GRMHD simulations. And so there are analytical expressions for the luminosity of the jet as a function of various quantities, including the spin of the black hole. One thing that we don't know is the strength of the magnetic field in galactic centers, because the results depend very strongly on that. And because we don't know that, I place a free parameter in front of these luminosities too. And this is another example of, and I'll try to fit these parameters this parameter to observations. And this is another example, so example of what I said in the beginning. This is a semi-analytical model is a way to use observations to make up for our ignorance. In this case, our ignorance of the magnetic field in the center of galaxies. And then I include, of course, the effect of these jets on their surroundings, the Aegean feedback. And the last final slide before I go to the results is, I include the effect of black hole mergers. So whenever two galaxies merge, the black holes merge as well, and they produce gravitational waveforms. And the two black holes merge, they produce gravitational waveforms, and they produce a black hole remnant which has a certain mass and a certain spin. And again, in principle, one should run a full numerical simulation, numerical relativity simulation, to calculate the final mass and final spin. However, fortunately, people, including myself, have been looking at fitting the results of numerical simulations with analytical formulas. And so we can predict the final mass of the black hole resulting from the merger, its spin, its kick velocity, very accurately. So I'm talking about the kick velocity in particular, because whenever two black holes merge, you expect that the black hole remnant will be imparted a kick in a certain direction, because gravitational wave emission is, in general, anisotropic. So people have looked at these kicks in numerical simulations, and they found kick velocities that are very large, about 5,000 kilometers per second, which are typically large enough for the black hole to escape their galactic host. So in principle, two black holes could merge, and the remnant could escape from the galaxy due to the kick imparted by gravitational waves. And this is something I include in my model, because I check at each merger whether the black hole is retained in the galaxy or not. And finally, of course, I take into account the coupling between the spin up of the black hole and the viscosity of the matter, what I call the Bardeen-Peterson effect. So if the black holes live in a gas-rich environment, I assume that their spins are aligned by the frame-dragging interaction with the matter, whereas in a gas-poor environment, I assume a random orientation for the spins. Well, this is complicated, but again, unfortunately, if you want to do the things well, this is what you should do. So as I said, there are bits of physics that we don't understand, and this is why my model has some of this.
So I'm trying to understand how you actually can model this, because if the velocity is very big, then it's going to escape the galaxy. If it's very small, then it's going to stay put. But then obviously, if there's something in between, then it's going to,
bob back and forth.
What are you going to do with it then?
Oh, well, I'll just discard it in my model.
I
just discard it, yes. In principle, you could have black holes wandering the space between the galaxies.
So what is the limit, basically? Like, how far can it wander that you don't discard it?
I check whether it's retained in the baryonic part of the galaxy, so the disk and bulge. So if it is left wandering in the halo, I essentially discard it. That's an assumption. I don't think it makes much difference as the result. The reason being that you don't have so many of this.
I was going to ask, what fraction of the time do you actually get one of these super kick configurations?
Say again?
What fraction of the time do you actually have one of these super kick configurations?
I'll show that. I have a slide on it. As well, maybe I'll answer quickly that question. So if you start at high redshift with a lot of dark matter halos, and then these merge, and then they merge to one. Typically, you don't have a black hole seed in all of these. Only in the bigger halos you have a black hole seed. So typically, you have very few, you will not have many merger events. So in most cases, when two galaxies merge, there is no black hole merger at all, especially in the beginning. And then as time goes by, you typically have different masses for the two black holes. So one black hole is bigger than the other. In that case, you don't have a super kick. Mm-hmm. So super kicks are possible only when the masses of the black holes are similar. So we don't have many of them. I don't know if that's...
But it doesn't explain how you pick the threshold or why it doesn't But you're saying there aren't that many super kicks, so it doesn't matter.
I'll show you later.
Yeah, it's also because dynamical friction settles down at the center very quickly.
But that's then the question is that would be the kind of question this one kick is
If you have a black hole wandering in the halo and you have two halos merging, mm-hmm. it's hard for me to think what can bring the two black holes together, because the two halos will merge, the dynamical friction will bring the two galaxies together. But if the black hole is not inside the galaxy, I don't think the black holes can be. There would be maybe two black holes, a black hole wandering in the halo and one inside the galaxy, but what brings them together?
Everything. If there is dynamical friction, so if the black hole is wandering, it's going to eventually sink to the center. But the thing is, if it wanders too far off, there won't be enough time.
That's not something I include in my model. I don't think, again, the results will be affected. But in principle, I could try that. I never thought of trying that. But that's actually a good point. Actually, the referee of the paper suggested that, but I never did it. Maybe it's you. Well, so as I said, I have a number of free parameters, and I want to parameter because I want to parameterize my ignorance. And so these are four parameters: the efficiency with which supernova transfer outflows to the galaxy, which is this one parameter that I had in one of my countless equations. I have an AGM feedback efficiency, which accounts for the strength of the magnetic field in galactic centers that we don't know. I have this proportionality constant, which I mentioned is a completely in this relation, which is a phenomenological one. So that's a free parameter. And I have another free parameter, which is the black hole accretion time scale, the lifetime of a quasar, this. And this I try to fit to simulation, to observation. So I don't have time to go into the details, but I include a number of observations, both in the local universe and at higher redshift. But if I want to get to the end, I'll rather skip the details. So this is what I get finally for the evolution of the black hole spins. So this is the mass of the black hole in log scale, of course, and this is the spin of the black hole, the magnitude at least. And the color code is the number of black holes in each bin. So this is for a light seed scenario. So you start with seed black holes that have mass of about 100 solar masses, which is why you see a lot of black holes at about 10 to the 2 solar masses. And this is a heavy seed scenario in which you have black holes initially at about 10 to the 5 solar masses. And so this is already redshift 7. This is not the redshift at which I start my simulations. I start at redshift 20 typically. Or in the case of heavy seeds, a bit at redshift 15. But you see that preferably at high redshift, you have higher spins. So black holes seem to have, the distribution seems to be skewed towards high spins. And this, in fact, is what you see at lower redshift as well. So at redshift 6, you again see distribution which has preferably high spins. And the reason why you see this is that at high redshift, galaxies have a lot of gas. So black holes typically accrete and merge in gas-rich environments. So you expect the Bardeen-Peterson effect to align the accretion disk with their spin. And the same in the case of mergers, you expect mergers to happen with aligned spins. However, as time goes by, black holes start launching their jets in the galaxy. And therefore, they quench star formation. And they eject matter from the galaxy. So the jets essentially heat the galaxy up. And they eject also matter from the galaxy. So the galaxies become more and more gas poor environments. So you start seeing preferentially low spins. So this is a redshift equal 4. You start seeing a bimodal distribution, high spins and small spins. And then at redshift equals 3, black holes, the quasar luminosity function has almost peaked. And you see you have many black holes accreting chaotically in gas poor environments. And this gives rise to this peak at small spins. And this peak at high spins is caused by the black holes that have accreted in the past coherently.
So, question. The way you do this, is it like a Monte Carlo thing, or is this?
As I said, I integrate essentially a set of all these along my dark matter merger tree. So,
so you have like a bunch of merger trees that you're on the
basis. Yeah, but, and then I weight them through using the cluster mass function. So I simulate many galaxies, essentially. Yeah. So each of these points is actually a galaxy.
So I can't help but notice the lack of 10 to the 10 solar mass black holes. And we know that there ought to be some of those by Z of 7.
Yeah, but they're very rare.
Right.
Yeah, I have let me see. I should have a black hole mass function at Z equals.
I don't know those values.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to through all these slides. I mean, this is just. This is mass function at Z equals 0.
So, but even at, I mean, when we see these, you know, brightest quasars that
universe-type
things, that they're extraordinary. So there's, you know, one or two of them. But one of the difficulties I thought they presented, and this gets back to the light versus heavy seed, was that you just didn't have enough time to grow a 10 to the 10
in the light seed scenario,
by a billion years.
So
I wonder about those parameters that you let change, like the accretion time. Do you have to make them pathological in order to get those kinds of objects? How are those related for those two sets of pictures?
Yeah, so I need quite a large lifetime for quasars, about 10 to the 8 years. So this is a pretty large timescale for a quasar. I can also have different versions of the model in which I limit accretion, I add into limit the accretion rate. So instead of setting the luminosity the timescale of a quasar, I set the maximum Eddington accretion rate, and I need to set that to about twice the Eddington limit. And that does the trick. And that, I mean, I don't have pictures for the luminosity function of quasars as function of redshift, but I looked at that, and it's true. My model is not perfect. It's calibrated on the average, on the middle luminosities. It's not perfect at high masses. Essentially, I could add other free parameters in the model and try to fit the results
more.
I was
just wondering if you were driven to pathological situations.
No, I don't think it's necessarily pathological. I can show you the parameters that I use. Yeah, I'm not going to go through this, no worry. Yeah, these are the parameters. You see, lifetime for quasar, 4 times 8 times 10 to the 8 years. And there are people who try to put observational limits on the lifetime of quasars, and this is barely in the time scale of a.
Those are both the same numbers.
Yeah.
So the heavy seeds and the light seeds have exactly the same parameters?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they work. I mean, I didn't run an extensive search on the parameters. This is one set of parameters that work in this particular model. Okay. Well, I want to go through. I think I was here. So you see this bimodal distribution when you go to larger and larger times. So more recent times, you start seeing preferentially small spins. And at z equals 1, you start seeing just a peak at low spins. And peak at this is 0.5, 0. And the reason why I need this is why I said in the beginning that the average efficiency from the solid time argument is 10%. If I had a model with very high spins, I would have a hard time fitting both. I tried this. And I have a very hard time fitting both the black hole mass function and the luminosity function. This is an answer to your question. So you need actually small spins if you want to fit both luminosity of quasars and mass function. So the question that you might ask is this consistent with data at all? So maybe I'll show you this picture. So this is essentially what Avery, I think, was asking about the Soltan argument. What can you say observationally about the efficiency of quasars from observations by comparing the quasar luminosity function and the mass function of black holes? And this is something that people did. So they estimated the radiative efficiency of quasars as function of time, as function of redshift in different mass ranges. And so remember my first slide, the radiative efficiency is a proxy for the spin of the black holes. And although there are large errors, you see that the efficiency decreases at recent times. So this seems to point at smaller spins at recent times and larger spins at early times. And this is something that I actually get exactly in my model. I actually didn't know about this result before I put my paper on the archive, and these people wrote to me.
But for all the figures aside, except for up under the 9, data pretty much looks constant.
Yeah, but this is actually,
And this is a log scale.
10 to the 8. Yeah, that's true. There are big error bars.
I'm not
saying,
just 10 to the 8. All three of them, aside from 10 to the 9, don't show any significant decrease at low C.
Yeah.
If we ignore the gray line, just a little bit.
That's true. I'm not saying that my model reproduces exactly this, but this is, I mean, in the higher mass range, at least it does. I mean, you can also say this is not significant because look at the error bars. I mean, there's no way you can. What I want to suggest is that, in fact, there are other observations that seem to point at different, exactly the opposite behavior. So you can actually measure using X-ray observations the spin of AGNs in the local universe, and they seem preferably to predict high spins. So I don't know if you heard of these iron K alpha lines, but they predict.
And measure high spins.
Say again?
You said predict high spins.
I have
These are measurements.
That's a measurement. These are measurements. But the thing, as always in astrophysics, I mean, you should ask what is the error. These measurements seem to give the opposite trend as the Soltan argument trend that I gave you before. And in fact, the very same group analyzing the same data can predict widely different values for the spin. So this is an object in which you have the one group predicts almost extremal spin, another group predicts retrograde accretion. So what I want to say is that you really need gravitational waves to settle this. And so what I did in my model, maybe I will spend the last few minutes talking about that, is to, given my model, how many gravitational wave events should you see, provided that we have a space-based detector. So I try to use my model to calculate event rates for gravitational wave detectors, because that would be really what will allow us to learn something about galaxy formation. Because if you rely on electromagnetic observations, there are systematics that you need to understand and which we don't presently understand. Whereas gravitational waves are a cleaner probe of this very same phenomenon. So these are predictions of my model for the number of event rates per year of observations for different mass ranges. So M bin is the mass of the binary. And different mass ranges correspond to different detectors. For the time being, you can concentrate on the blue and green lines. So this is a light seed scenario. And if you sum up all these bins, it turns out that LISA or ELISA should be able to see a few events per year, whereas in the case of a heavy seed scenario, it should see hundreds of events per year. So simply by switching on a gravitational wave detector, we'll be able to distinguish between a heavy seed and the light seed scenario. And this is, to me, remarkable, because this is there's no other way I know. Maybe the luminosity function of quasar can tell you something about whether you have a light seed model or a heavy seed model, but this is much more powerful, because there's a real difference in event rates.
So the green line is the ground-based, the like Virgo, you know, LIGO.
No, unfortunately, Virgo will not, in this regime, will not. You have to wait until the Einstein telescope, which is a third-generation ground-based detector. So I mean, some of other of my work has to do with ground-based detectors. What I'm focusing here is future space-based or ground-based detectors. None of these, unfortunately, has.
Your estimate seems lower than what people advertising LIGO are doing.
No, but this is not, again, sorry, I was not clear. This is not for LIGO at all. No, this is not.
No, but here you're predicting the number of merger.
Yeah, but this is in a mass range. This is mass range, well, between 10 to the 2 and 10 to the 4. These are two big black holes to be detected by LIGO. They're outside the LIGO frequency band. So what people do when they calculate event rates for LIGO is a different thing. They calculate the evolution of binary systems, or stellar binary systems. This is not at all what I do here. This is just for future detectors. Well, I'll have to
test binary galaxies versus binary stars.
Yeah, so sorry, it wasn't clear, but I'll have to rush this up a little bit. So the other thing I can predict is how many mergers happen with aligned spins or misaligned spins, because I said that's a prediction that can be tested with gravitational wave detectors. So this is the fraction of mergers that happen with aligned spins or in gas-rich environments as a function of redshift and as a function of the and in different mass bins. So as you see, in general, the number of events with aligned spins decreases as redshift becomes smaller. And so again, this is something that ELISA will be able to test. So this is another way in which gravitational wave detectors will be able to tell us something about galaxy formation. And I also have predictions for the typical mass ratios that happen in binary mergers. This is, again, something that you can actually test. So I had a whole second part about how to include the effect of the spins on the gravitational waveforms. And this is actually what I did for most times. And this was what I just talked about was about my spare time project and what I really liked. This was what I was paid for. And I did a lot of work on that. And it's very important work, I think, for both ground-based and future-based interferometers, because if you want to measure the spins using gravitational waves, you first have to include the effect of the spins in the gravitational waveforms in the first place. And this uses a model called the effective one-body model, but I guess it's pointless to try to explain that in two words. And if you're interested, feel free to stop by. I have more slides than I can ever. I have many slides, and maybe I'll just go to the conclusion. I didn't think to show all this, of course, but. So my conclusion is that maybe my model is not perfect, but at least it's falsifiable. And there are many ways in which you can test it. One of them is having a better X-ray data, X-ray observations of black hole spins, or even better, you can have a gravitational wave detector. You may ask the question, what if we don't have a space-based gravitational wave detector? Well, I believe that in order to convince funding agencies that we do need such a detector, we have to show that we can do exciting science with it. So this is what I'd like to do, what I plan to do in the future. And this model that I presented is for one of my first attempts in the field. Some other work I did is about including strong field effects in gravitational waveforms, and in particular the effect of frame dragging in gravitational waveforms. And this I did through a model called the effective one-body model. Again, if you want to know more about that, Justin Mignol. The only thing I want to say is that this model uses information from post-Newtonian theory, numerical simulations, and self-force formalism. And I also did other work that I wasn't able to talk about today, but I talked about that with some of you. And if anyone else wants to know about that, feel free to ask. Thanks for your attention. Please.
So I guess I'm a little bit unclear exactly what the model is. So you showed us four ODEs with these four parameters. Is that the model?
There is a set of couple of ODEs. There are 10 couple of ODEs which I evolve in a merger tree, a long merger tree. So is that clear? I can expand on that. I have various components. So I essentially have I listed them somewhere. Here. Yeah, so these are the components I have. I have a dark matter halo. So I have a density. I have a density for the dark matter. I use a Navarro-Franke-White profile. Then I superimpose to that a hot gas component. I calculate the density of that hot gas component at each step by assuming that it is in hydrodynamical equilibrium with the dark matter halo. Then I have a cold gas component, which I distinguish in bulges and disks, star components, bulges and disks. I have essentially a reservoir for the black hole to accrete. So these are different mass components. And what I have in the model is a set of ODEs, m dot equals something for each one of these ODEs. And they're all couple of these. I evolve also the metallicities of the galaxy. I evolve other quantities. I evolve the black hole spin. So this translates into a set of couple of ODEs. I think I have 10 ODEs. And then I evolve them along each branch of the dark matter merger tree. And whenever there is a node, whenever there is a merger, I merge two branches into one by using these semi-analytical formulas that predict the spin of the black hole remnant, for instance, from the initial configuration of the binary. I also have recipes for, I take into account the set dynamical friction models. So those enter into the merger part. I can expand more on that, but it's essentially a set of ODEs above the long dark matter merger tree.
So you have one system of equations per galaxy.
Per galaxy, and then I have
rule when the galaxies merge for what happens.
Yeah, and I typically use for each of these figures, I use 1,000 galaxies. And then I weight, because big systems are the rarest in the universe, I have to weight my results with what we call a mass function. So, yeah, that's essentially what I do. Monte Carlo. For each galaxy, I run the model for each galaxy a lot of times, essentially.
So you mentioned something about not all initial halos have a seed black hole. So how do you determine which ones have it and how?
Oh yeah, so it's the highest peak of the, so you can define a density contrast for your primordial density field. So you can define the density contrast rho minus rho average divided by rho. So you define delta equals rho perturbed minus rho background divided by rho background. I mean, there are people who studied this more in detail, and they take the results, and they so essentially you place seed black holes in the peaks. So this quantity delta is a Gaussian field. So you place. So whenever you have a deviation from the average, which is more than 3.5 sigma, in the highest, essentially where the density contrast is higher, you place a seed black hole. This is the short answer. So in the big galaxies, you place a black hole. And this comes from people who study this.
So for you just assume there's some Gaussian power spectrum.
Yeah, and whenever
you get some probability.
Yeah, in the tail seal of the distribution, I place a black hole.
Okay.
More questions?
Please. Oh.
Go ahead.
Please.
So one of the results you highlighted was that there is this substantial disparity between how many events you might expect if you start with lower mass or higher mass seeds. Is it possible to understand that in the in a simple way? My guess would be that if you start off with a lot of massive black holes, they grow primarily through mergers of massive black holes, whereas if you start off with a lot of low mass black holes, you have a lot of very unequal mass ratio mergers that fall below some sort of detection threshold. Or is there is there a simple way to understand the result without all the machinery?
Yeah, because initially, suppose you start, suppose you have the first generation of mergers. So suppose these are your initial dark matter halos. So you place a black hole in the highest, in the biggest systems, because in the tails of the Gaussian field, essentially. So consider the first generation of mergers. So in the case in which you have a system of two of light seeds, this is a merger between a 100 solar mass black hole and a 100 solar mass black hole, because the seeds are of that mass. This will be outside Lise's window. Whereas if these start as 10 to the 5 black holes, this would be in Lise's range already. So this is why you have many more in a heavy seed scenario. Actually, I should mention that this there's another model by Marta Volonteri, who predicted the same thing. So there are essentially two models that my model is the second that's been used to show this. So I essentially confirmed previous results for this particular quantity. Her model is less sophisticated than mine, so she cannot do other things that I do, but this thing she sees as well. So I'm pretty confident that this effect is real. But, you know, it's better to have two codes confirming the same thing. Since this is LISA is a billion euro project, so you don't want to be wrong on this. This is, the simple answer to the question.
I think that statement enforces what Avery said, that the sharpest thing we would like to understand in a clear physical argument, not through codes.
Say again? I haven't
understood. Because the project is so expensive, you would want to have an assurance that has nothing to do with numerical code, but some very basic physical arguments.
Yeah, I mean, probably a simpler approach would be to compare. I don't think there is any way
So would you say the same thing about when you build an airplane, it's an expensive airplane, so you simple argument
that. No, absolutely. You should know for a simple reason why it should fly.
So you're asking whether
1977.
I would think so. And you would first put it into a wind tunnel before you fly it in the air, right?
Well, that's right? That's sophisticated, right? That's
no, but you can run. What you can do is exactly what Marta does. This other code does. So you take my model, you strip it down to the minimum, so you eliminate all the galactic part. And then you simply have dark matter halos with black holes inside. And whenever two dark matter halos merge, the black holes merge as well. That you can do. But then you lose all the information about the evolution of the spin. So I'm not saying that. So as far as the event rates for gravitational wave detectors are concerned, you can actually strip down the model to just dark matter halos and black holes in them. And you can use one thing that we call in astrophysics, the M sigma relation to relate, or the Magorian relation to relate the mass of the halo to the mass of the seed black hole. So you just end up with a model with just dark matter and black holes. And whenever two dark matter halos merge, the black holes merge as well. This you can do. And the results are very similar to what I found. This was, in fact, the first test I did. I compared to existing results, of course. Yeah.
Please.
So
have you done anything about pulsar timing?
That's one thing on my to-do list, but I'm just by myself. So
I see.
That's one thing you can do, actually. Yeah, you can calculate the event rates for pulsar timing.
Yeah, because all these other probes, they're kind of competition for pulsar timing.
Yeah.
Much more readily available.
There are also, that's true. Yeah, that's something like.
The other thing is, you said your model is falsifiable. I think that's usually the objection to semi-analytic models, that they're not falsifiable. You have so many parameters.
I have four. If you look at there are semi-analytical models that are much more sophisticated than mine. They fit many more data, but they have also many more free parameters. The Durham model, other people have similar models, but they have many more parameters. I just have four. I mean, I don't think four.
But then you don't fit as many data points.
Yeah, but I still fit more than four. Typically, you have n parameters and then data. I have four, and I fit more data at least twice as much. So I'm not saying that it's perfect. I mean,
okay, so if there's nothing else urgent, and Nico will be around for today, and maybe tomorrow if you find him.
Yeah, in the morning I'll be here.
In the morning? And let's thank Enrico again.